Hey folks, this is Moot Davis, and you're listening to the Hold My Hat podcast. Welcome back. It's been a hell of a long time since we've done the old podcast thing. I think the idea started when I was working on the cruise ships and just wanted to have a way to keep my name out there while I was hiding on the high seas. Anyway, now living in Nashville, Tennessee, and working on some new music, and getting in the studio and doing some recording, and just wanted to begin to reach out and try to communicate with the world outside again. On this first episode of the new podcast series, I'm interviewing a guy named Bo Meek. Now, Bo is the road manager, the first one I ever had, and he was with us on the very first bus tour with Pete Anderson and Michelle Schacht, and he's got some awesome stories, and also a really scary story about when our drummer, John Palmer, at the time, went missing in Texas. So stay tuned, and talk to you after.
Right on. So, so you were saying that we met how many years ago?
21 years ago.
That's crazy.
Right. I think I walked into Little Dog Records when you were living in the drum room.
Right.
And I was 25, and I'm 46 now.
Crazy. I just turned 49.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we're still standing, man.
Yeah.
Things are still moving.
Yeah, it's true. So now, how did you come to be in California? Because you're not originally from California, right?
No.
Where are you from originally?
Man, kind of a long, windy road. You know, I've lived, Tennessee's my 11th state I've lived in.
Wow.
Was born in Texas.
Okay.
But moved right away to Germany with my parents before I ever knew what was going on.
Were they in the military or?
My dad was, but at the time that we moved, he was like a college professor and then became a dean of campus.
Mm-hmm.
So they shipped him to Germany to, he basically was the dean of a college campus on a military base in Germany.
Okay.
So I was too young to really know much about that. I have some reel-to-reel film of it. And then we moved back and moved to Colorado shortly after that. My parents split.
Yeah.
So I just, I kind of moved back and forth with whoever had the better deal at the time, like tons of kids do.
Yeah.
So I've lived in Colorado, Wyoming, Washington State, New Mexico for a short period, Arizona, California. And then once I started touring and looking at house prices, like, I knew L.A. and California was out of the picture, so
yeah.
At that time, Tennessee was really affordable.
Okay.
So that's how I got here. But how I moved to California, I was in Las Vegas, and I went to UNLV, and I got out of college and still wanted to pursue music to some extent.
Sure.
So I moved to L.A. to go to a little music school in Pasadena.
Okay.
It was like 1 year.
Yeah.
I went through that program. It was a guitar program.
Right.
It was great. Got out of that, and you know, definitely knew how to play my instrument a lot better than when I showed up.
Sure.
And wanted to make a punch at it. But at that time, it was a lot of pay-to-play stuff in L.A.
Yeah.
And there were, like, a few different kinds of bands happening. Like, you're either in a rock band or a heavy metal band or these bands kind of doing, like, rap rock. And I just...
Yeah.
I didn't see myself going in that direction. But Craigslist had just come out.
Right.
And it was maybe like 6 months before that we found a roommate because we needed one. We lived in a bad part of Pasadena.
Okay.
Totally broke.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Oh, there is. Yeah. Washington and Fair Oaks. Maybe it's cleaned up now. Probably would change. But I got on Craigslist and just looked for like under music gigs.
Yeah.
And there was all these label internships.
Right.
And I got like 5 phone numbers. And out of the 5, like, and some of them were big, Sony, Universal,
sure.
Capitol, and then
yeah.
One of them said Americana label.
Interesting.
And I took down the number and called, and Jennifer Harold
right.
answered, and I went in for an interview all dressed up. And
did you really? Okay.
Felt pretty overdressed, like, for
yeah.
you know, the relaxness of that situation.
Yeah.
But that's how I got my foot in the door and met you there. Like,
crazy.
Probably that day you stumbled
just
out.
Lurking
the
around.
Room and like, hey, this is Moot. He's on the label and we're, you know, working his record and we just got it done. And
yeah.
I'm going to make a head to go of it. And first thing I did was start mailing out your CDs. Like,
okay.
People that were like, on a mailing list.
Sure.
You know? It's like old school roots.
Sure.
The ground running CD sales.
Yeah.
Going to the post office.
Yeah.
Do that. So yeah, that's how I got to LA through
through
Vegas, trying to pursue
you
know, the dream.
Yeah.
So many people go to LA to do.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was it's kind of hard to describe that time there, because if you weren't there, because there was still a music business. It was like before Napster. It was before any kind of digital, there was still a business, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's funny.
Napster was kind of happening. The only reason I remember it is I used it a little bit to get music for music school.
Like
versions you couldn't find. And we were broke. Like, we couldn't go buy CDs. So at the time, you know, the ability to just download a song to learn to be able to do your schoolwork with
was
nice. But it wasn't prevalent. I think over the next 3 years is like when it really happened.
Right.
Then got conked out.
Yeah.
People realized that it was a bad deal. They weren't getting some kind of cut.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, it just kind of changed the whole game. You know?
Yeah.
Just,
you had to tour.
Yeah.
There was no more just making records and being a, a hit off of that. You had to hit the ground.
So, okay. So you did the interview and you, started Little Dog and how long was it before, and you were doing like the office stuff, you know, just mailing out stuff.
Yeah.
What else was going on at the label at the time? Like, what were the other things they were working on? Do you remember?
He had finished a Cisco record.
Right. Right.
To this day, I don't know what happened to that guy.
I don't know. Great songs on that album, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a good writer.
Yeah.
The Blazers.
Yep.
And then he had a few, like, kind of things that had happened that, you know, like Scott Joss, I think, was the fiddle player. I don't know if he played on your records or not.
I don't think he did, no. I think he's going to play on this next one, though.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. God, it's 1 degree of separation.
I know. You know, it's wacky.
People that you meet in those early days, it comes back around.
Yeah.
Eventually. But yeah, yours was the main thing.
Yeah.
That's what was probably the hot item at the moment because... You know, Pete was pretty invested in it, and you were pretty invested in it. And
sure.
I was there 1 month, like, cleaning the bathroom, mailing out CDs. He started trusting me with some of his guitars to just, like, tune them and kind of work on them, and he had a ton, so I became, like, his tech.
Right.
And then you guys got on that tour with Michelle.
Oh, so you were only there 1 month when that happened.
1 month, and you guys hit the road, so I... basically kind of begged to get on the tour bus and said, I'll do it for free.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did.
Yeah.
And I definitely did. It was tough. And that's where I met Danny Love, who was the bus driver.
Right.
That he was working for Bob Dylan at that time. But he was in off time, and he was doing a favor for Pete, so he came out.
Yeah.
And that's where I met him later on in life. That's now what I do for a living.
Right.
Bus drive for bands.
Right.
But yeah, we were there 1 month and we all hit the road. And at first I was like the guitar tech kind of stage guy that would just set up everything and try to get it in place.
Right.
But by like day three, you know, I think it was more by name, but I became the road manager.
Okay.
I had no clue what that was. And honestly, I wasn't very good at it.
I think
in retrospect, I did it for you for about 9 months to a year. I was technically your road manager.
Yeah.
But
it
was never something that I was impassioned about.
So sure.
You can't be good at something if you don't
love it.
But I got through it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I did, and I learned a ton.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But yeah, 1 month, man, we hit the road. And
that's crazy.
Right out of...
And that, how long, do you remember how long that tour was?
I think we were out probably 3.5 weeks, and we did about 12 or 13 shows.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of spotty.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you would open.
Right.
And then the band would stay on, and Michelle would come do her set with the same band. And then you'd come on for encore to do a few songs at the end.
That's so funny. I don't even
know. It was actually a cool mix.
Yeah.
Know, especially for back then. Like, I thought it was a pretty cool ticket to go to a concert and see that.
Yeah. Interesting. It's funny. I don't even remember. I remember very little of the Michelle Shock stuff. You know, like, I just...
She was in and out. We were on the bus the whole time, but she had
she would fly places.
She flew in, was on the bus for a few days, and then she had to take off to do other stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But we were
we had two kids on there with, well, not kids, but like two brothers, right? Yeah. Two twins or something. Do you remember this? Like two brothers who were like supposed to document the whole thing, like with video footage.
They were.
Do you remember their names? I don't remember their names.
One of them, they were the Weiner brothers.
Ah, yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right.
I remember one of them was Seth. I don't remember the other guy's name.
Right.
But they had cameras rolling the whole time.
Yeah.
They were just kind of like documenting the whole thing.
And we were just kids. I mean, we're all in our 20s, so, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
24, 25.
Yeah.
Time. I couldn't sleep on the tour bus. Like,
really?
I never got used to the movement.
Right.
I think when we crawled in there, we were crawling into like whatever band was on there with Michelle before, like it was their same bedding.
Oh, you know, perfect.
Like,
yeah.
It wasn't like
good, nice and clean.
Yeah. You know, it was, I mean, probably the way it should be just to kick our butts into gear.
Yeah.
But yeah, those two dudes followed us and had cameras rolling the whole time. I don't know whatever happened to that film footage. I'm sure
God
locks
somewhere
in a closet.
God only knows. Yeah. Yeah. Jeez, that's crazy. From my perspective, I mean, like, I had been sitting at, I'm trying to remember when I moved to Little Dog. Because I got the deal with Pete through Rosie Flores. I was playing at Tootsie's, you know, with my little trio, you know, and I think her and her band, back when, like, people would go to Lower Broad and have a drink,
mm-hmm.
not like the madhouse it is now, but, like, you know, back in the day. And I think they came in, we were playing during the day, and they sat through part of our set, and she said, do you want to come on the road, you know, and just open for me and maybe help drive and all that kind of stuff? And I was like, yeah, I think that sounds great. You know, it was like a small run, like, up to New York and back, so it was kind of perfect. And somewhere along the way, you know, played her a little bit of the demo that we were making, you know, here in Nashville. And she says, well, when you're done, you should send this to Pete. You know, like, I can let me know and I'll put in the word for you and get you the address. And that's what happened. So, like, number one, the album was done here. You know, like we had finished a whole album. And then I get a call from Pete, you know. And he said, you know, I'd like to work with you. Do you want to make an album? And I was like, all right, well, let me figure out how to, you know, sort of pay off everybody that was, you know, involved in this.
Yeah.
And then we'll, you know, get to work. And so once that happened, you know, like, I went out for the initial recording session, which I think we did it in a couple of days. You know, I think I went out there. Do you know Joe Buck? The bass player.
I've heard of him plenty. I've never ran into him personally.
Yeah.
His name's on a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a character, but, you know, like, he was pretty helpful in getting me to play on Lower Broadway at Layla's and stuff like that, where we were, like, playing every Friday and Saturday night. And for some reason, Pete brought him out there the same time he brought me out to play on the album, to play upright on a few songs.
Yeah.
So we flew out together. We knew, but we're like, okay. You know, so we flew out together. We did the recording and flew home. And then I'm just like, I'm now back in Nashville. I'm just working my job and playing Layla's. And I'm like trying to beg Pete, like, let me move out there. Like, you know, help me find a way to move out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and finally talked him into it. And I think I left Nashville, went home for a summer to New Jersey and worked a construction job. And then right after summer ended, I drove out there.
Oh.
And so I'd been sitting there, you know, doing all, like, the prep work and everything and working, rehearsing up bands and stuff.
Practicing your butt off, trying to get ready to go. You know?
Till that time when you came around and we started that tour.
Wow.
I was just sitting idle, you know?
I didn't know the preemptive.
Yeah.
I figured you had just moved there, done the record, and were
No.
Like holding the house until.
No, that was okay. I was just living it little dog.
You went and recorded the whole album and then came back to Nashville and was like,
right.
Now what am I going
to
do?
Right. Right. And well, I had a couple of things to do. Like, you know, Pete gave me a checklist of things I needed to do. And one of them was the vehicle, right? Yeah, like I had a car, had to get the van. So I did that. And, you know, just tying up loose ends and doing all that kind of stuff. But at a certain point, I was like, and I thought if I was out there and like under their foot all the time, that they'd do something with me. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So.
You get more traction going anyway.
Well, yeah, anything. Like, I, you know, I feel like I'd. You know, like, I felt like this is huge and this is like, I can't just be like, not yeah. there. And he's like, well, you know, it'd be much easier to tour out of Nashville. You can hit a lot more places quicker. And I was like, well, but still, I think, you know, I think I should be out there. And so, yeah. And to his credit, I mean, he said, you know, come crash on the floor. Never, you know, was,
yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, the Little Dog was like a mom and pop operation, you know?
Totally was. Yeah. Yeah. It's in like a building that you wouldn't even know that it's there.
Yeah.
You know, the front of it didn't say anything.
Mm-mm.
The back of it was just a little parking
yeah.
spot and a door.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
I went there, I thought I was in the wrong place until I got inside. And then you're like, oh, okay, this is a built out proper studio.
Yeah. Yeah. God, I remember when I went there. The day they picked me up at the airport, me and Joe Buck, and I'm probably tortured Joe the whole way out there, saying, like, I'm terrified he's going to send me home because I'm not a good musician.
Yeah.
You know? And he was like, don't worry about it. You know, but, like, I was petrified when I got there.
Oh, man, yeah.
And
I didn't know you were going through that part.
Oh, I was terrified when I got there, you know? And I was so, like, in that beginning stage, I was so pliable. So malleable, you know, like so willing yeah. to do anything to push it, you know, to make it work.
That's kind of what Little Dog Records was anyway. It was kind of an incubator for talent.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You went there on your own accord and there's no promise of anything, but
right.
you knew you were going to get a lot of experience, good, bad, otherwise, like,
right.
you know, and
right.
come out the other end. Like, well,
yeah,
that was a lot, you know,
yeah.
it was a college.
It really was.
Sorts. I watched you become a better player while you were there, for sure. Especially
sure.
the on stage part.
Like yeah.
At the beginning, I would never say you were timid. You're always confident in your songs.
Right.
But like more of a stage presence and
sure.
how you talk and how you lead from one song into the next.
Yeah.
And just kind of like hitting the audience on the head.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
with
yeah.
some powerful stuff. Like song yeah. after song. Like, God, that was a good tune. God, that's another good tune.
Oh, you know, cool. Like, dude, I remember the first show I played with Pete, I was terrified, just terrified, and just holding yeah. on for dear life, you know, like,
I bet.
It was,
do you remember where the first show was? Like,
I can see the place.
It was in LA?
It was an LA place, and it was like
that little ramshackle place that had a bunch of funny stuff in it, like
the Kulaks. No, it wasn't Kulaks. No, we had our act together by Kulaks.
Okay.
But this was it was kind of an Asian named place.
Okay.
I forget what it was. It was cool. It was an actual venue. Like I'd been there and you know seen Blake play before. I knew Blake at all. And,
okay.
You know, Waylon Payne and all them play. I just can't remember the name. But I think, you know, like Pete was still doing a lot of stuff with Dwight. They were still together at that point, you know, and I
yeah.
think that this was maybe when I was out there recording we planned to do this.
Okay.
And I don't think Pete quite learned the set yet, you know, like I think he just like, I can just hop up there and it was just
yeah,
kind of like.
He's cool with going off the cuff.
Yeah, like, yeah. You know, so like it was just terrifying for me. But yeah, then once I moved out there, we settled in and like, and I guess him and Dwight had split by that point.
Yeah.
And I remember getting a call from Jennifer saying like, well, you know, he was supposed to be out on tour with Dwight, but now he's going to be on tour with you, you know? And it was just like,
so come get ready.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. You're moving here, you know, and
yeah,
this
yeah.
is what's happening.
Timing is right.
Yeah. And, okay. And, but he was, I mean, he was older than we are now, right? Then.
Yeah.
And he was, I never, like, we slept on the floor, you know what I mean? Like, oh, yeah. He was tough, tough as nails.
Yeah,
I mean.
Yeah. Slept on the benches in the van.
Yeah.
I think there was either one hotel room or maybe two, but I think more one.
Yeah.
And we were all crashing on the floor.
Yeah.
I think Pete would sometimes even go out to the van, just crash on the couch, yeah, just to have his own space.
Yeah, sure.
And then I think you guys built the van out a little bit.
Yeah.
But I was gone by that time.
Yeah. Wise. That van was a death trap, dude. Oh, God. It was a death trap.
Well, I mean, as far as going into the bus driving world after that, like, it took a couple years for me to get my license and
right,
properly on a tour and, like, any kind of experience for somebody to take a chance on to hire me.
Right.
Being in a van and doing all that stuff before GPS, like,
yeah,
you know, we were Googling stuff. I went to a public library in Austin one day because we were just there. It's like, well, we got to go to Alpine, Texas,
right,
little place called Railroad Blues. And yeah. I'm like, I don't know how to get, I mean,
yeah,
I can look at a map and kind of get there, but I went and Googled and printed out pages and had a marker and
Like, we would just have
basic analog
pages
stuff.
And pages of MapQuest directions.
Yeah, trading off driving the van, I'd do it as much as I could.
Yeah. Well, the first time I ever saw you drive the bus was on that first tour, and Danny Love would have to piss.
Yeah,
and you go up there, and I was, and it was like the beginning of it all. Like,
yeah, back then you could do it like. We don't swap wheels like that. We call it just swap seat while it's doing cruise control. But
yeah.
I remember on the way back, I was just like, and we'll get into another story where we stopped at a radio station
in
Mount Pleasant, Texas.
Yeah.
But we were in West Texas and headed back to L.A. And he had been driving for a while. Mm-hmm. It was kind of before major log books came in and like rules. You know, it was kind of gray area where you could just drive a bus. Now we're actually on electronic things where it'll tell you to pull over, like you're gonna get a violation.
Really? Yeah. Oh, so like amount of sleep or amount of time you've been driving?
Time you can drive, yeah. Now
interesting.
It's very regulated. It's all computerized.
I had no idea.
You gotta follow. Yeah, things have totally in my lifetime as a bus driver.
Right.
From like pretty cowboy open road stuff to like actually it's very regulated. And
yeah.
How you have to, you know, get your sleep. Have a certain amount of time off, getting physicals.
Wow, you know, like, I had no idea.
Really pretty. It's almost like airline pilots.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You gotta, you know, not quite, you know.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
don't fly at 35,000 feet, but
right.
we have shoulders we can pull over on. But still,
right.
the amount of rigorous stuff that you have to do to keep in compliance is totally changed from when I started.
That's crazy, and it hasn't been that long of a time since since the cowboy
years,
days. Yeah,
think, but,
yeah.
He was looking kind of tired, and I was up there talking to him, and he had let me kind of take the wheel a couple times real short while he went to the restroom.
Yeah.
But this time he got up and I sat down, and he sat there for about 30 minutes and just kind of went through all the controls from left to right of the bus while
yeah.
I'm steering. And, he got up and he goes, "I'm going to go to bed." And he went to bed for like 9 hours.
Wow, and you just drove the whole time?
Yeah, when he got up, I hadn't stopped. I had just stayed right there and
cruise
control,
yeah.
but I knew how to take it out. And like I had done it, I think I even took an exit and went back on just to experience it.
Yeah.
But he got up and came up front and was just like, "You want a job?"
That's awesome, dude.
That. But
yeah.
It took 2 years, you know.
Yeah.
I couldn't just get the job. I had to go get a permit. And,
yeah.
And that's kind of where it transitioned from me working with you as a road manager. I started working with Michelle
mm-hmm.
because she owned a bus.
Right.
And I wanted to gravitate towards that.
Right.
So she gave me this kind of cool situation for a while where I played guitar for her and ran her bus, or
okay.
kept her bus maintained
okay.
in Burbank. Like, she stored it in Burbank.
Yeah.
So I lived in Pasadena. I'd go there and, you know, do little stuff to it to keep it working and up to shape. We actually never used it for tours, me and her did. We did mostly fly dates.
Okay.
But then it got to a point where she realized she wasn't using the bus, and she kind of, I think she actually donated it to her church at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the playing situation between me and her had petered out because she figured out that she can do it better on her solo, just
sure.
by herself
yeah,
with
yeah.
nobody else, and have zero overhead.
Yeah, but, yeah, sure.
for the 9 months I did, it was like a whole another college. Like, yeah, she took me under her wing. It was, I mean, crazy stuff and gigs that we did.
Yeah, man. That's awesome.
That's how it all bloomed out of that.
That's great. That's,
I remember sitting down with Pete to say, like, you know, I'm going to go work with Michelle. I can't be the road manager anymore. I'm broke. I need to, I need to do more stuff.
Fuck yeah. Yeah.
And he was really cool, you know. He was like an uncle or something, like, hey, man, this is a pro way to do it. You know?
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Look, you know, there are people who came out of there on their feet, and there are people who like came out like on their backs, you know what I mean? Like, and I feel like, you were one of the success stories of that place. You know, I feel like you and maybe Adam Hood came out, you know, like on your feet, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's that's great. That's so cool how it started, you know? Yeah. But yeah, I remember that Danny's like, I gotta piss.
Let me drive. Yeah, it was on that first adventure that there was that kind of crazy radio thing.
Right. Yeah. So wait, before we get into that, I remember there was a show. I think it was in Texas, and I think it was kind of early on in the tour. And if I'm wrong, if I'm remembering it wrong, just let me know. But was there a scenario where you were setting up and you knocked Michelle's guitar off the stage somewhere?
I remember it well. We were at an in-store.
Uh-huh.
And I'm gonna say I think it was actually Austin.
Okay.
Could have been Nashville, but I think it was Austin.
Okay.
And we were at some, I almost like to say Zia Records or something like that.
Right.
But we were in there and we were setting up for an in-store, and it was going to be you and Pete just doing a couple solo acoustic songs, I think. And then him and Michelle doing a couple solo acoustic songs from the records that he had produced for her in the early or late 80s, early 90s or something. And we had set up her guitar, and there was a little, you know, her plug was plugged in and it was strung around. And something happened. I got whirly in this little cement dance floor area, and her guitar just took a header. Boom. And I
was it face first down onto the,
it was face first. And my eyes just lit up, and Pete was right there.
Yeah.
And he just like calmly walked over. He goes, it's all right. Grab it, put it back on the stand. I'll take a look at it. I'll tune it up, and it's going to be fine. And it brought me out of this.
Yeah.
Thank God Michelle was somewhere else at the moment, and it actually didn't do a damn thing.
Yeah.
But it took a header and hit the nut on the top of the neck, and that's the spot if a guitar is going to break.
Yeah, it snaps right
when
there.
It,
yeah.
When it falls, it would have done it, but good luckily it didn't. It was a brand new guitar.
What was the guitar?
It was a Taylor. She was endorsed by him.
Okay.
And it was a brand new one they had sent her.
That's awesome.
Maybe even out on tour. Like,
that's awesome.
But tuned it up. She didn't notice a thing, and I was just, you know, my butt was puckered the whole time they were doing the in-store, waiting for it to go out of tune.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank God it never did, but yeah.
Pete was great in those, in certain circumstances, he was so, like,
he's been through it before.
Yeah, yeah, he was so great in certain circumstances, he really was.
It was a calm in the storm,
yeah.
Especially in my, you know, as green as you say you were by that time, you had already done tons of gigs down on Broadway. Like,
sure.
You had show experience.
Yeah.
Me, I was as green as it could get.
Yeah,
other
yeah.
than attending concerts as an audience member. Now all of a sudden you're setting up stuff in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know a thing. But in that 3-week tour, man, I kind of like went from 0 to 10 on the knowledge spectrum of being able to, how many things we went through on that little tour of like, wow, okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And then when you're done with that, it's going to be a lot more hard work.
Like, yeah.
It kind of never ends. It can get better.
Yeah.
But it's still there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You got to grind.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. So, okay. So let's get into Texas. So this is, this is again, this very first tour that, and this is the first bus tour I've ever been on, right?
Yeah.
And
most
this is
of us, other than other than Pete and Danny and Michelle.
Right, yeah, 100%.
I think we're new.
And then who, I remember Palmer was the drummer, John Palmer was the drummer, and then who was the bass player? Was it Lucas? It was
Lucas Cheadle. Yeah.
And then we had the two brothers, the Weiner brothers. We had Pete.
You.
Me. You.
Me, yeah.
And Danny Love.
And Danny Love.
Okay.
That was it.
Right.
At that time, Michelle. Yeah, it was the end of the tour. There were no more gigs.
Okay, so that was the end of the tour.
We were driving back from Nashville. The bus actually had an issue, and we had to stop in Memphis for a full day. So we all scattered in Memphis and did, you know, whatever we could do in a 7 or 8 hour period while the bus got fixed.
I can only imagine what happened.
Yeah, the bus got fixed, and then we started rolling, and it was... I think it had gotten fixed like early in the day. So by the time we got into the corner of Texas, Texarkana's right at the Arkansas-Texas border, we started going in and we got to a place called Mount Pleasant.
Right.
And Danny, the bus driver, knew some dude at a radio station for some weird reason. Like he either went there with another artist to do like a, you know.
So this was like a last-minute kind of thing then?
It was as last-minute as you could get. Okay, He just, like, called and they answered.
Crazy.
And he just said, I'm, you know, we're driving. And we're pretty close. We're, like, 30 minutes away or 45 minutes away. And we got this great artist on board, and Pete Anderson's the guitar player. And he's got a new record out, and we've been touring it, and it sounds fantastic. If you guys are there and on air right now, we'd stop in and do an in-studio little show. And he pulled, you know, off the freeway and went down this little road, and we're in this parking lot of the radio station.
Now, my recollection of the, like, the geography of this place is it's literally a one road, right? There's just one road, and it's like a one lane on one side and one on the other, right? Going opposite directions. And then there is nothing out there except this radio station.
Right. Like, you know, you could see... like a couple of farm buildings, you know, maybe another half mile away, but it was a little bit hilly, so you couldn't really see. So, yeah, it was the radio station and not anything else.
Right, and the radio station was like a cinder block building, right? And there was just a massive radio tower. That's what I remember, right?
That is it.
Okay, all right, yeah, so go ahead.
he pulled into the parking lot, we went in, and, you know, they're pretty normal...
It was a normal.
People gave you a little interview.
Yep.
Everybody brought something in. I think Palmer had like a tambourine that he barely did something on. He had some little setup that he could barely play, like brushes on a, you know, almost a box or just maybe had a practice head or something that could barely sound.
Yep.
And then you and Pete had guitars. Lucas actually brought his upright in. I think.
Okay.
Sat a little bit away so it didn't like get too muddy. And you guys did a few songs. It was great.
Yeah.
You know? And then we're like, man, thank you so much for having us. And the radio people start talking to you and like interviewing you, asking you about the tour and stuff. In the meantime, John got up to go use the restroom, I thought. But he was also a jogger. He'd like, he was the guy that would get up and go for a jog.
Yeah.
So we lost track of that part, but everybody's saying goodbyes and high fives, and they had shut the radio station down for the night and went to like pre-programmed stuff. Like, all right, we're signing off. Thank you, Moot Davis and Pete Anderson for stopping in.
Yeah.
And you know, you guys had best of luck with everything. Have a great night. Safe travels. And shut it down. We all go outside.
Yeah.
And get on the bus.
Yeah.
And we're like doing kind of a I was doing a head count as a road manager.
Well, Palmer made it back on the bus. He definitely made it back on the bus, and then as we rolled down the road, a hair, like, not very far. Like, I don't know. It wasn't very far. Like, we're not talking, like, you could, you if you stood at the back of the bus, you could see the radio station, like, just right across the road.
1/8 of a mile, maybe.
Yeah, I'm nothing far, and Palmer said, oh, shit, I forgot my metronome or something, you know, like, something like that, my little
beep thing. Yeah, a little Thomas in-ear thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, we pulled over. And he ran out, and he started running down to the radio station, which is like 2 minutes away.
Yeah.
And then, like, 15 minutes goes by, and Pete's like, where's Palmer, you know? And so we waited there more, like, oh, maybe he's in the restroom or whatever, you know, so we're just chilling. And then I think, like, a solid 20-some minutes went by, And he's like, will you go look for him real quick? So I get out there, and it's quiet. There's nothing, like, happening. You know, it's, like, completely.
Yeah, but it just hit dark. Like, it had just gotten a solid dark.
Yeah, from, yeah. You know, and so, like, I see the radio station. So I didn't run anywhere. I just walked to the radio station, and there's, like, a little there was, like, that little not a bridge, but, like, a little.
A ditch.
Yeah, there's a ditch with, like, the road water. Goes over it.
Yeah,
right.
There's water in it.
So I walked over that, and I walked into the radio station, and I was, like, I thought I was going to have to knock on the – I knocked on the door, and then I tried the door, and the door is open. So I just walked in, and I see the guy doing stuff on the – who knows what he was – he was playing and maybe record. I don't know.
Yeah, like the nighttime DJ.
And I look through the door window, you know, and he's like, hang on, I'm on the thing. And I was like, okay, I see Palmer's thing there.
Yeah.
On the thing, the little beatbox. And so, like, and then he's like, finished what he does, and he waves me in. And I said, he goes, how did you get in here? And I said, well, the front door was open. And he goes, no, I locked it on the way when I let you guys out. I was like, I don't know. It was open. Maybe Palmer, maybe John. And he goes, I haven't seen John at all. And I was like, well, he came back for this, but it's still there. So I grabbed that. I was like, maybe he's in the restroom. I don't know. Check the restroom. He's not there. So I was like, well, maybe he's back at the bus. Maybe he couldn't get in, you know, like, so I walk back to the bus with his thing. Bus is just sitting there in the dark.
Yeah.
And is John back on? And I go, no. And so, like, everybody, and I told him what had just happened in the radio station, you know, like the guy, the door was supposed to be locked and there was, you know, Palmer's thing was still there. No sign of Palmer. And Pete goes, shit, we got to go look for him. You know, like, concerned now instead of just vaguely pissed, you know?
Yeah. It went from annoying to like, oh, my God, something's happened here.
All right, so we all pile out, and we just start shouting his name.
Yeah.
Right? Do you remember before we're, like, getting in? So, like, we're, like, and we're not. I mean, how many bus lengths do you think we were from the radio station, from where we were parked?
You know, maybe like four when he stopped on the road to let you out, but he backed back into the bus station, so he was out of the road.
Right,
so.
Right.
But still, like, maybe two bus lengths away from the actual building.
It was so close.
Yeah,
it
there's
was
no so, way you couldn't see it if you were...
There's no way you could get lost. Yeah, there's no... Yeah. And so we're shouting. Me, Pete, maybe you, maybe somebody else. We go to the radio station again. Pete talks to the radio guy.
Yeah.
And we look all through the radio station.
Yeah, yeah.
Shouting, walk around the radio station, and there's nothing else out there. There's nowhere to go. And so we walk back to the bus. Did he come back to the bus? No, he's not on the bus. Okay. That's when me and Pete jump in that drainage ditch thing, and we're like, you know, up to our, like, you know,
now by this chest. Time, I remember really, really vividly, like, we got out. Danny Love was there, and he kept saying, I feel like he's in this water right here. I feel like he's submerged. So you guys did get in the water.
Yeah, so me and Pete got in the water.
We found a water hose piece.
Did we?
From somewhere, or we got it off the bus, and Pete tied the water hose around his stomach.
Okay, so he could...
To walk in case he, like, plunged down into something, we could pull him back.
Yeah, yeah.
He was not in the water. They checked everywhere. We had a stick or a poker.
I remember, and it's like, well, maybe he jogged and had a heart attack and fell in the water and, like, drowned.
Yeah.
I'm like, because it was just unfathomable.
How the hell is
that? Where would you go? Where is there to go? And so, then when he wasn't in there and we're looking around, I mean, what do you think we're at? Like 45 minutes, 50 minutes at this point?
Yeah.
To have him being gone? So we call the cops, right? We call the police.
Yeah.
And was it one or two police cars that came?
God, it feels like more. It feels like by the
end
time
it was whacking.
Like four or five. Like,
yeah.
You know, first it was a couple cops, and then they called a sheriff, and a sheriff showed up.
Right.
And we were out in the back field of that radio station. They had full lights on. There's a couple, like, abandoned, like, little outbuildings.
And we started getting, like, a horror film vibe, you know? Like,
it was Blair Witch.
Yeah, there was some weird shit going on. They had their guns out at one point. Do you remember this, right?
Yeah, when we went to the sheds in the back of that field.
They got weirded out.
Freaked out.
Yeah, they got weirded out.
They got weirded out at us eventually.
They thought we, like, did something to them.
Or they thought we were on drugs.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, we were so normal.
Oh, dude, it was a totally...
Yeah, it was weird.
In retrospect, it was probably like the least amount of craziness on a tour that I'd ever been on, especially now in comparison.
Right, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, it was a sober, but like nobody was drinking, nobody was doing drugs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, nothing.
We were just trying to get home.
Yeah, we were just trying, you know, but they thought, they were like, well, a lot of weird things happen on these tour buses. I remember the cop saying that. I was like, dude, we're not doing that. This is a weird situation.
Yeah, so a couple of cop cars show up, and, you know, we did give them the rundown of what's been going on.
Yeah.
And they got flashlights. They're looking around. We're still all calling his name.
Yeah.
Again, there was nowhere to fucking go. Yeah, yeah. Go back to the radio station with the cops, right? Not that it's, you know, far distance, but we'd go there. We're walking all around that. And then you're right. Towards the end, there seemed like there was more cops there. And then as we were closing in on those two weird buildings in the back, we got that horror show vibe.
Yeah.
They drew their guns, but there was nothing.
No.
I mean, there was nothing happening. There was no noises anywhere.
Field,
so they put their guns back and they're like, we don't know what happened. Remember? And then, so as we're walking back, Palmer, out of the fucking darkness, walks up and says, hey guys. You know, like.
Yeah, like he jogged. I remember being at the front of the radio station because that's where one of the only lights was.
You
could see besides having a flashlight.
Yeah.
And at that time, I had the T-Mobile flip phone.
Right.
You know, there was no text. There was no smartphone.
Right.
I don't think he had a phone on him.
No.
You know, not all of us even had
phones. Yeah, yeah.
It was a miracle that I did.
But, yeah.
I remember hearing this dude, and he runs up, and I'm like, Palmer, and there's a few other people, and Pete's like maybe like 40 feet away, and he turns around and he's like, Palmer. And he came up and he's just like, hey guys, what's going on? And we're like, what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He's like, dude, we've been looking for you. We thought you left your metronome, so
the
bus stopped, you hopped off, and that was like, feels like ages ago, but probably in real time, like an hour ago.
Yeah.
And now here we are. And
we must have been at like an hour and a half, hour 40, 45 minutes, somewhere around there now from where he went missing. I mean, it was...
Yeah.
I mean, he was gone.
Dude, we were talking about the idea that, A, he had a daughter. I think she was like 15, 16, 17.
I remember,
like, how are we going to explain this to a daughter?
Right.
Like, we were like... You know, the worst case scenario thoughts came into all of our heads.
But yeah.
Then he's back and he's okay.
And yeah. I don't remember anything amiss about him, like physically.
No.
Like he wasn't dirty. He wasn't anything, right?
No, and he wasn't even talking weird. He was like totally normal. It's like that space and time, it just like left. But he said he had gotten chased by some dogs.
Like, well, he wouldn't say anything right away, right? Man, he wasn't saying anything, and then we get on the bus and we're like, well, thank God, you know, he's not dead. You know? But then
we're just glad we're all
and
on
he's
the bus
a, he's
and
in the, he's away in the back. He's in the back. What do they call that back thing in the buses?
The back lounge.
Yeah. So he's in there by himself, and Pete's like, you got to go talk to him. You got to go see what the hell happened. I was like, fuck, why me? Like,
he's your drummer.
So I go back there. I was like, man, you know, I was like, what happened? He goes, what are you talking about? I was like, John, like, you're gone. What happened? Like,
we called the cops.
You didn't even get your metronome. Like, what? You walked off, just walk me through it. Like, you stepped off the bus, and what happened?
Yeah.
And that's when he said that some dogs chased him. There were no dogs. There was no dog sounds.
Yeah, we didn't hear any dogs.
And did he say something about it? Was there?
He said he had grabbed a stick and was like fending him off.
And did he say something about it?
And then he got on another road, I thought, like, and just got turned around. Like, you know, it came in pieces. It was kind of, you know, everybody on the bus had their own, like, story in their head, and kind of everybody got real quiet.
Well, everybody's like, well, fuck, I don't know if I can trust him now. Like, I don't know what's going to happen, you know? Like, not like, I mean, and Palmer, up until this point, was like, he's the life of the party.
Solid citizen.
Life of the party. Yeah. Super fun, super good at picking up girls, and like, just a great guy. Like, he was awesome.
Yeah.
You know? And a friend, like
total friend. Yeah.
In this world of like, you know, shit, you know, being real serious and heavy. Like, he was, like, lighthearted and happy and like, somebody I could look to and be like, thank God you're here. You know, like, he was a running mate of mine after shows and stuff, you know, so.
Yes. And he was, I remember him either being, like, he was from Northern California, either Redding or something like that. Like, kind of near where Merle Haggard, like, grew up.
Sure.
So he kind of had, like, you know, country sensibility about him.
Yeah.
Like, no frills.
Yeah, he
like,
was a good dude, tell man. You,
yeah.
And so it was just so out of character that this happened.
Totally.
And it was such like, I don't even know if it's him now. Like,
you
know,
like an alien. And
like, what? Yeah. How does that
close
happen?
Close Encounters of the Third Kind, like, kind of came down.
Seriously. And, you know, Danny's saying, like, all this stuff, like, it could have been this, could have been that. I was like, God damn it. You know, like.
Yeah, it got weirder as we drove.
Yeah.
Suspicions.
Yeah.
And, like, the conspiracy theories were running rampant.
I mean, to this day, that's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me. Like, that somebody just sort of vanishes and then sort of walks out of the dark.
That's still one of the craziest stories I have.
Right. Yeah.
To this day.
And you know,
and I knew him plenty of time after that. Like, I haven't ran into him in years.
Right.
I definitely hope he's doing well, man. That guy was a great drummer, especially in the rockabilly world. He's kind of like, you know, a standard in LA
and
for a long
so
time.
He's so funny.
Yeah.
Dude, I mean, the musicianship aside, which I kind of take for granted, like, he was great as a musician, but like. But he was really, really funny and really, like, really light and helped things.
Yeah.
Made my life easier just as far as, like, being able to decompress with somebody, you know, from, like, the pressure cooker that it was, you know? So, yeah. But you knew him afterwards then.
Yeah. No, he still came around. Like, he still had done a couple little things at Little Dog. He played with you for a little while longer after that, but he also played with, I think, Wanda Jackson and Peter Tork.
Yep.
And those were, like, gigs that he made pretty well off of, so he tended to them. He stuck with them and couldn't do as many other things. So somewhere around there, Blake Oswald became your drummer.
Right, well.
And then I did a couple tours with you guys and Lucas had left during that time, and then I forget the guy that had come in. He was kind of a guitar tech, big hefty guy. He was a Canadian.
Okay, yeah, Dave.
Dave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dave was a bass player. Yeah.
Dave was a bass player, and I did a couple tours with you guys, short little like Texas runs in the van, and maybe some Northern California stuff, and then I left. Probably like 6 months after that or something like that.
Yeah.
And you guys kept hitting the pavement really hard.
Yeah. Well, I remember we were sitting in Little Dog one day and Pete goes, you gotta fire Palmer. And I was like, fuck, man. He's like
family.
Yeah. Like, we were buds. Like, we just had I really enjoyed him. And he goes, well, you know, it's like, I don't know what happened out there. And I was like, well, what do I tell him? Like, he hasn't, you know. And he's like, well, just bring that up and tell him he can't shuffle. I was like, oh, fuck me.
Oh, no.
So I get on the, I go in the drum room.
It was a great shuffle.
I know. Look. And I thought, well, you know, this is my band, right? I got to, like, learn how to cut people and stuff like that.
Yeah,
no,
this is part of the process, man.
But this was like the most unhappy cut of, you know, like, that I had to do. So I call him. He's like, hey, buddy, what's that? You know, I was like, John, I'm so sorry, buddy. I gotta let you go. And he goes, why? I was like, well, the whole Texas thing. He goes, what happened in Texas? And I was like, what is he? There's no answer to it.
He forgot about it again.
You didn't give me a good answer. Like, I can't like say like you were chased by dogs and there were no, like, I didn't, there was like,
there was no resolve.
Nobody trusted you anymore. Like there was like,
we were worried you're gonna pull a knife out.
And he goes, well, is that it? And I was like, I don't know. Like, Pete says you can't shuffle.
throwing spaghetti at the wall. Like, like, went from that to a personal insult.
And I loved him. I really did. I really loved Palmer. Jesus Christ. Fuck. I saw him once years later. This is after I'd sort of separated from Pete and all that kind of stuff. And I stopped by Viva Cantina, and oh, yeah. And Palmer was out, like, loading in. He goes, Moot, does Pete know you're here?
Just checking.
Yeah, it's just being funny.
Yeah, man, there was that first little 3-week tour on a bus, man. We learned a lot of lessons there.
Yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah, that's crazy. Well, I had no idea that the whole bus driver thing had become so regulated. Like, I just remember, like you were saying, the cowboy days of it.
Yeah, so it, you know, when I left Little Dog, I still had, like, a toe in the water there. Like, I'd come if I had time off from doing stuff with Michelle and do some stuff just because it was such a college, and Jennifer did so many good things for me. Like, you know, I didn't get paid for a long... None of us were making money. All of us... It was, you know, shoestring budgets
because
we were trying to build something. But I got to a point where I had to give more guitar lessons. Mm-hmm. Michelle gave me a gig that paid me some to get on the road. Jennifer was actually giving me money on the side just to make sure I had gas to get to the studio.
Yeah.
I eventually got, like, a little wage to come do studio days. But eventually, like... Michelle became more priority and I had less time, so I kind of left. And then finally it took years of, you know, getting my permit and Michelle having a bus and putting me on insurance so that I could legally drive it to a test.
Man,
to get my license it took 2 solid years.
Yeah.
And then no company will hire you right away because you don't have any experience.
Yeah.
So I had to just sit it out and, like, work for her and maintain the bus.
That's crazy. Yeah.
And then finally a company took a chance on me in Arizona. Yeah. It was Danny Love had a few buses that he owned.
Yeah.
And he ran on the side when in addition to driving for Dylan at the time.
Right.
And the company ran through out of Arizona, hired me.
Yeah.
And the first tour I did was just a 2-day thing as a what they call a double driver. So when they know the hours are going to be long for a driver, they put another driver on the bus so you guys swapped.
Right.
And the bus could run without the other guy getting tired.
Yeah.
And I was still kind of in the gray area. Like, we had log books, but it wasn't super regulated. But they knew that... It was a rap tour, it went horrible for me. Like, me and the bus driver were two dudes sitting in the middle of, like, 17 guys from New York that were all in rap groups.
Okay.
And it was a bad tour that went bankrupt while we were on it. Luckily, I was only on for 2 days.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bus driver that I was helping out didn't even want a double driver in the first place because he didn't like him, but he took a liking to me.
Okay.
And we got back, and we had to go through Phoenix, and the boss of that company that took a chance on me came and asked him, like, hey, how did that kid do?
Yeah.
In the middle of all this stuff, because he could see what kind of mess it was.
And, yeah.
The driver was just like, hey, if you don't give him a set of keys, somebody's going to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's green.
Yeah,
He gets behind the bus, and he knows exactly what to do.
Yeah.
And how to drive. So far, everything else he doesn't have a clue about.
Right.
He's got that. So
yeah,
I got done with that, and I luckily got a check. The rest of the tour went bankrupt. Several drivers didn't get paid.
Crazy.
And the guy who was running the company, I came back, and he goes, "Well, you know, Pete says you did very well, and I need to give you a set of keys."
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you, son, other than good luck and don't fuck up. And he was right.
Yeah.
You know, that's all you got.
Right.
You know, don't screw up because it's going to make the news.
Right.
You will
don't kill people with the bus. Yeah,
you will be on the news and it will not be good.
Yeah.
And B, the good luck part is just keep your eyes wide open and learn from every mistake quietly.
Right.
Just like.
Right.
Any end of this business. Like, if you don't, you know, you're not going to survive.
All right.
And luckily I caught on quick to that. I think what I took to more than anything, like, of all those gigs, even the stuff with you, like, you know, being a half-ass road manager or guitar tech or selling merch or settling with a venue or doing sound.
Mm-hmm.
What I liked about the bus driving part is by the time that it really took hold and I became good at it, I didn't sleep on the bus anymore. I wasn't taking a bunk. You went to a hotel.
Yeah.
So I got to get away.
Yeah, that's the big time, right?
Everybody else is sitting at the gig, like twiddling their thumbs, waiting for time to pass, waiting for the gig to happen, you know, and I get to get away and just go into a hotel room and be in my own world and get a good sleep and then go back. And after a while, I was like, I think that's my thing.
Yeah.
You know, I still play guitar and I write songs, but I don't have any ambition to, like, you know, if you're going to be a songwriter and really want it to work, you got to get out and gig.
Yeah.
And I don't love gigging.
Right.
Unfortunately, I love playing. I love, like, you know, me and Blake have jammed.
Yeah.
And he's played on some stuff that I did.
Yeah.
And, I really love that end of it, but it's kind of more of a personal thing where, like, I don't see myself making a living off of it unless I met the right person where it's just like, you know what? That's.
Yeah.
You know, I could plug into that. I like that, what that person doing. It's hard to find.
Yeah.
I mean, you know very well, like, getting a band on board and everybody, like, being in one direction is a tough thing to do.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
I feel like with bus driving, I kind of finally found my space and how it worked. I mean,
it's huge.
Yeah. I mean, you live in my neighborhood now. And
yeah.
I've been here, like, 16 years ago. I bought a house here.
Yeah.
Got out of L.A.
Yeah.
And at the time, I thought, you know, for $135,000, I paid way too much.
Yeah.
It's really worked out, man.
Yeah, that's awesome. You
know, knock on wood.
A funny side note, and we just found this out this evening, but I've stayed at Bo's house before with the band as we were touring through Nashville. I don't know, how many years ago is this?
I'd say the last time you were at my house was probably like 15 years ago.
Yeah. So we were doing tours and we passed through town and he was nice enough to let us stay there. But you hadn't thought about the place since. And it turns out he lives directly across the street from me. Like, literally, like, I could see his house from my house. So.
And you've been here for 2 years.
I've been here for 2 years.
Like, as much as, I mean, I'm not home a lot. I actually live part-time in Montana now.
Okay. Fair.
Near Bozeman, Montana.
Yeah.
A little town called Livingston.
Okay.
Little town that I just, it's one of those places that you wake up every day and you're like, I can't believe I'm here.
Right, right.
So if I have more than a week off, I fly there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I off. This is base camp, Madison, Tennessee.
The
bus company I work at is kind of near White's Creek.
Right.
And that's where my bus parks. So Nashville's still home.
Yeah.
My residence, but... I've been able to kind of part-time it in Montana, and
you
know, it's just like I kind of got the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
In a way.
Too funny.
Yeah. But the fact that you and Blake live in my neighborhood it makes my neighborhood cooler.
Yeah, well, good.
I got people that I can, like, hang out
with
and, you know, shoot the shit, and we can laugh.
Yeah.
We got a lot of history.
Like, yeah,
and
we sure
didn't
do.
Even really know it.
Yeah.
You know, you record an hour worth of a podcast.
Yeah.
Like, actually, we got a lot we could talk about.
Yeah. Too funny. Well, I'm going to grab another drink. How are you on your beer?
I'll take one more.
Okay. Yeah. And then, I want to talk more about your bus driving experiences.
Do you have a ranch water, actually?
Do I have what now?
A ranch water?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love one of those.
You
got
it. Here you go, boss.
So, your first tour driving then was the ill-fated rap tour.
Yeah.
And then what came after that? And
God, right away, out of the box. So, Danny Love, the guy who taught me to drive, I got into one of his buses, but it was leased through this company out of Arizona. The first tour I did was a band called Train.
Okay.
Out of kind of San Francisco.
Okay.
The lead singer's name is Pat Monahan. They have a couple huge, huge hits.
Okay.
Drops of Jupiter is one of them.
Okay. I
hate to sound stereotypical.
No, no.
Just name somebody's hits, but
that's
like a reference point.
Yeah, sure.
Did a full month with them, with their crew.
Yeah.
At first. And then the very next tour, it was kind of weird. I got offered a full-time gig, kind of, but it faded away, and it was with an American Idol winner named Bo Bice, and he was kind of like country rock,
like
Lynyrd Skynyrd-ish, you know, talented guy, he could sing, I think he's still around and does stuff.
What year was this?
God, well, I did sell merchandise for 2 years. In the 2 years where I couldn't get a bus job, I sold merchandise on Bob Dylan for 2 years.
How was that?
And yeah, it was, that's its own thing.
Yeah.
Like, I had a pace car trailer.
Yeah.
And I drove this Ford F-350. It was kind of a fifth wheel, and we set up it. It was Willie Nelson, Bob Dylan, and Merle Haggard.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it for 2 years in a row. And then the next year, John Mellencamp joined that whole same procession.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. I mean...
Did you get to be around those guys, or...?
Yeah. Well, you had to, because they were selling their merch, too. It was all big one thing.
Okay.
And we stayed at the same hotels as them, so...
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, I ran into Willie a couple times. I didn't have, like, long conversations with him.
Yeah.
Bob pretty much, like, kind of kept to himself.
Yeah.
And he had his own program going.
Was Donnie Heron playing steel for Bob? And did you get to hang with him?
I talked to Donnie Heron.
He's a sweetheart.
Because I knew him.
Yeah. He was my landlord when I moved to town.
Yeah. Well, his wife at the time also lived in that house.
Yeah.
Disgrace Land.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think. And I think Donnie maybe... I think they bought that separate. Like, I don't know.
I think they had gotten divorced.
Divorced.
And she had married somebody else and lived in Disgrace Land. Yeah.
I think that divorce happened while I was on the road with him over that 2 year period.
I don't doubt that. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, selling... That's where I probably really learned the rules of the road.
Yeah.
Because we did so many dates.
Yeah.
And the stand, we would set up these huge things we call gill rack stands. And just these massive things that unfolded from a road case.
Yeah.
And you could set up every t-shirt and have lights. And it looked like it was a full-on setup.
Right.
It looked like, you know, like Hollywood designed this stand to sell stuff from.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stands face the stage. So,
yeah.
I think I calculated, I watched 55 Willie Nelson sets.
Yeah.
During the 2 years, quite a bit of Bob, and then the trailer that we had would set up outside of these minor league baseball park stands.
Okay.
And you'd run it out of the trailer.
Like, yeah.
The shirts were in there, and then at the end of the night, you packed everything back in that trailer. I'd drive through the night, stop somewhere, sleep for 4 hours in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
And then just kick back,
Jeez.
Wake up, drive the rest of the way into the venue, sleep a couple more hours, and then start your 18-hour day.
Wow.
Yeah, so I did that 2 years until I got my license. And the reason I remember the year is because Bob Dylan had these stamped t-shirts from the tour, and I have one from 05 and 06. So 06 was the last stamped t-shirt that I have, which I always thought was weird because when they put your head on a stamp, it usually means you died.
Yeah, yeah.
But these shirts, obviously still well.
Yeah, yeah.
At this point, but the last one I have is 06. I was like, it was 2 months after that last tour that I got my first gig on that rap tour.
Oh, okay.
And they took
a chance. God, what a change to go to that. Yeah.
I started in 06, and that was my first go. And then Train was the first tour. Bo Bice was the second.
Yeah.
And then I got on a couple little weird things, but I got on a big tour. The heavy metal band Tool.
Uh-huh, yep.
Had released a CD called 10,000 Days.
Okay.
And that went for a long time. That went for like 2 months.
Yeah.
And that was like the first time I'd been around tons of buses as a bus driver. It was like 12 buses.
Oh, wow.
And 15.
Just like in a convoy you guys would go?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, the buses left as people were done with their jobs.
Okay.
You know, like backline people are the people that like deal with instruments on stage. They're the first ones off. They pack up their crap, get on the bus, that bus leaves. So kind of convoy, but spread out.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you all arrive, you know, it's 6, 7 a.m.
Yeah.
At a gig, and you're all positioning and trying to keep all the people on the buses asleep.
Yeah. Well, you got to do it quiet. You can't, like, slam on the brakes and stuff. That's funny.
That's where I learned all the little isms of buses. Like, there are so many little things to keeping people asleep. And, you know, making their day a little bit better.
Right.
But then after that, like, I got my my feet going pretty good. And I ran into a couple bands after that. One of them was an Australian band named the John Butler Trio.
Okay.
And I did his tours for about 9 years.
Wow.
And they started overlap, like, to where he kept me busy 6 months out of the year.
Hey,
so
man,
all of a
awesome.
Sudden I went from doing 10 tours in a year with different artists to just this one guy.
Yeah.
For three or four tours in a year.
Yeah.
And then that rolled over to a Canadian band, the Bare Naked Ladies.
Right. Right.
And I had been with them for about 9 years.
Right.
And got really close with them.
That's awesome, dude.
It was cool. And then COVID hit
all of us. And what was that like for you?
It was horrible. I mean, actually, it was, in retrospect, it was probably the best thing that could have happened.
How so?
In like life appreciation ways.
Okay.
So I was, at the time, I had quit the company in Phoenix that I'd worked for 13 years. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I need a change. A, I want to be home more.
Yeah.
And I don't want to commute to Phoenix to start work.
Yeah.
Or live in the bus.
Yeah.
So I switched to a company here out of Nashville, and I had worked for a full year, and I had done a couple, one band came with me, the Bare Naked Ladies wanted to make a change, and they said, we're going to go here. So I kind of followed them to this company, kept with them for a year. And then the next year came up, and they weren't touring until the summer. So I went out with Amy Grant.
Okay. How was that?
Awesome. She's a super lovely person.
Yeah.
Great band, great people.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like a month tour, and it was, I had done something with them in 2019 at the end of the year, so they requested me back.
Yeah.
And it was like late February.
Yeah.
And they had 4 weeks worth of stuff on the books. So we went for a week and a half, and it got into the beginning of February, and that tornado hit Nashville.
Okay.
In East Nashville, and it destroyed a lot of stuff. And
yeah.
I think either one of her band members or one of the crew people had a house that they had to deal with. And COVID was on the horizon.
Like, right.
It had started doing some stuff. So they canceled a week and a half worth of stuff where we just sat at home. And then they said, we're going to pick back up and repeat those dates. So we'll add stuff on as we go. So that tornado hit. Nashville kind of cleaned up and got on its feet barely. We got back on the road, and we did 3 gigs, and we were in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and the gig barely came off because of the COVID thing starting to shut down in other places, and then we went to Knoxville, and we were able to pull off that show, but the health department was pretty down on it. They didn't want it to happen.
Yeah.
But the show was able to happen, and at the end of it, we all got on the bus, and they said, we're all going back to Nashville.
Yeah.
And we probably need to take 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
And then we'll just see what happens. We're going to rebook gigs.
So yeah.
We all came back. Everybody got off the bus. And then we went home, and within like 2 days, we got an email from the bus company saying, everybody's on furlough.
Right.
We don't know what exactly is going to happen, but we advise you all to do what's necessary for your family and yourselves' own well-being.
Right.
And I'm, you know, I think much like you, I don't have any kids and I've never been married.
Right, right.
So I got home and I just kind of looked at what my financial situation was at the time and what I had saved. And I was like, how long can I survive without any money coming in? Because that's what we may be facing.
Right.
And I came up with a number of like a year.
Yeah.
But that's living like.
Yeah.
I started a garden in my backyard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like.
Living tight.
I was like, okay, the truck's paid off. I have this mortgage. Like if I grew vegetables and just went shopping and maybe got into a food co-op something, or me and my neighbors joined together. Like I was thinking like, you know, in real time. And, came up with like a year, and 2 months into it, I was building a greenhouse in my backyard thinking like, man, this may be longer than a year. We may have to like really buckle down. And then I was able to go to Montana because we were able to fly. If you got a pass from a COVID test, you could hop on a plane fully masked with a certificate. And I went to Montana.
Yeah.
And, I had started getting to know this girl that lived there.
Okay.
And stayed there like a month and just was in heaven. I was like, this is the best place in the world. And I get a call from the bus company, and the guy who owned it at that time, it has sold since then, but he was quite an entrepreneur and wasn't going to let his business fail and found a way to employ some of us.
Yeah.
So I got a call to come back and work in the shop where they used to fix buses, and they cleared out all the machinery, set up tables, and somehow through this, like, at first he was delivering medical supplies, two places that would build COVID kits. Okay. And then those COVID kits were costing quite a bit for companies to do.
Yeah.
And he found a way to make them himself.
Okay.
And he got a contract with Amazon to make like 4 million wow. of these things, because at that time they were starting to rule what was an essential worker and what wasn't.
Right.
So Amazon was essential workers because they could deliver.
Yep.
You know, without touching and without yeah, you know, sure. all this stuff. So we started making COVID kits for Amazon
wow.
in boxes of 250. And so we went from driving buses to no work for 2 months.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we're sitting at these long tables with gloves on.
Yeah.
And
just assembling.
Yeah. And this, you know, the tubes that the little fluid would come in, we'd put a label on it, put a swab in it, put this other little kind of gauze pad with it, seal yeah. it up in a bag, and 250 of those went in a box, and it was production work.
Yeah.
So the more boxes and the better quality you did, you could get like overtime.
Yeah.
All of a sudden money, I was like, well, it's not bus driving money, but right. like all of a sudden I'm not spending that savings that I said I could survive for yeah. a year. It's like, well, I should keep with this, because yeah. the unemployment was coming and people were doing that, you know, like
yeah.
Stimulus, but it was going to run out.
Yeah.
And this guy was like, I'm going to keep this rolling as long as yeah, possible. Bet he was.
Yeah.
And it worked. You know, that was a whole different thing. We needed more manpower.
Yeah.
For a while, there were people that had gone through recovery programs and in halfway houses coming into this warehouse to work with us. So all of a sudden, you're sitting at a table with somebody who's just fresh out of rehab.
Right.
But they're on the way to a better life, hopefully.
Yeah.
But we didn't know it at the time, and even though we work in rock and roll and have been around tons of people that mm-hmm. need that in their lives, and you know, music businesses can take its toll.
Yeah.
People can fall victim to chemicals.
Sure.
I've seen it for sure.
Sure.
But these people came in, all of a sudden we're sitting side by side with them.
Yeah.
And I worked in there for 9 months.
Yeah.
And then the world started opening up slowly. We started doing drive-in movie theater tours right. with buses where okay. they'd set up a stage. People could get a negative COVID test, coming in their cars and tailgate in front of their car and watch the show on a stage. And they broadcast it on a yeah. big screen. But it's a drive-in movie theater places yeah. around the U.S., which is a dying
yeah.
thing,
well, yeah.
kind there of. I mean, there's been a little bit of resurgence, but that was the new touring.
Mm.
And I got some of those tours, but then I'd come back and work in the warehouse again.
So, yeah, sure.
The hard part was in the warehouse with people in recovery,
mm-hmm.
some slipped back into it.
Sure.
And yeah. over the course of the 9 months, I'm going to say we had, you know, probably 150 people in there. 50 of them were bus drivers, so the other 100 were either regular citizens or people in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
20 of those people fell back victim.
Sure.
Got reincarcerated.
Yeah.
We had 5 deaths.
8.
From yep. all different yeah. kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like your whole life worth of experience
yeah.
of the hard stuff.
Yeah.
Whether it's in your family or friends of that.
Yeah.
All happened in a 9-month period.
Yeah.
During the worst or the weirdest time.
Yeah.
That we've probably experienced in our lifetime.
Sure, yeah.
Of the world not operating as normally as it did.
Right.
And then slowly it started coming out, and I was kind of like on the fence, like, should I sell my house and move to Montana?
Mm-hmm.
Because I really like this life that
right.
is kind of starting to happen there, or stick with it. And I decided to stick with it because I was like, out of this, if it does open back up, because it was starting to show signs that it was going to come back to mm-hmm. normal, I'm like, drivers that were previous bus drivers, A, are going to be sold, they retire. B, they're going to go into truck driving because you're by yourself and you're an right. essential worker and you can right. still do it. Bus driving on tour was done.
Done, yeah.
But as it started to come back, I'm like, yeah, it's maybe worth it to stick with it. And then some are going to die.
Yeah.
Because there were some that were like in non-belief that this is an issue that can kill you.
Uh-huh.
And even though, you know, I could variate the opinion that they probably came on too, like we took it too serious, but we didn't know what we were dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some that did die of COVID. Well, I hung on, and even though I was with the Bare Naked Ladies before the shutdown, is kind of their full-time, or did all their tours, mm-hmm. they were in Canada. And even though American touring had opened up, you yeah. weren't allowed to go into Canada yet right. because of the COVID thing.
Right.
But Canada was operating, America was operating, you just couldn't cross the border.
Yeah.
So they had a Canadian tour, and they canceled like two or three in a row. And I was hanging on, and I finally got a tour with a group called Fish.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of similar to the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, and, yeah, yeah.
They've been put in like the jam band category.
Sure, sure.
They kind of play all types of, you know, yeah. like if you listen to their whole catalog, they got everything.
Yeah.
And I got on one of their tours, and I was supposed to just be like a production bus or a regular one.
Yeah.
And then at the last minute, one of the principal guys in the band's driver had some stuff he had to deal with, and mm-hmm. he didn't have clearance to drive or mm-hmm. wasn't going to be out on the road. So I filled in for him. And then about a month into it, he came to a show. And we were all still wearing masks yeah, at yeah. the time, but it was slowly happening. It was actually here in Nashville. And he announced his retirement to the guy that he'd been driving for 14 years.
Yeah.
And I was just subbing.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm kind of just waiting for the yeah. Naked Ladies to yeah. kind of go back again. But I was with him, and I finished out the year with him. And then the next year, didn't know what was going to happen. I got a call that I had just been reserved for the whole year.
Yeah.
Like, you got a long-term contract with the...
That's great, buddy.
With them and with the same guy.
Yeah.
And they'd like you to stay the whole year. So I stayed the whole year, and that's the only tour I did that year. I didn't...
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I went from, you know, 5 to 10 people on a bus.
Right.
Variably, because you have that many bunks, to yeah. just one.
Yeah.
And it was a whole new world.
Yeah.
It was like... All right, I had done some stuff. It's called star coach work, where you right. just have a, you know, like
yeah.
a guy or a wife or maybe even yeah. a dog or yeah. a kid. Yeah. And I had done some of that stuff sporadically.
Yeah.
Liked it some, didn't know how I really felt about it, but I like people. So,
yeah.
You know, when I had 4 or 5 people, it felt the best. But all right. of a sudden, just having one, I'm like, God, it's nice.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You're only dealing with one guy's schedule.
Yeah.
One guy's needs, if they even have any, and it's kind of turned out to be like the main reason I've stuck with this job is because it turned into that good of a gig.
Yeah. So
now I'm full-time employed with them. I don't work for anybody else.
Yeah.
I work through the same bus company that I was with through COVID.
So yeah.
They lease the bus on a long-term thing, but now I come in and out, and... if I'm here longer than a week, I go to Montana.
Yeah.
If not, I stay here and I'm able to come catch up with you
yeah.
now.
Yeah. Very cool, man.
The bus is 4 miles that way, so yeah. I actually Uber there.
Yeah. Too funny. Yeah.
Keep my car in my garage here. And
yeah.
It has turned into a whole different touring life.
Yeah.
I guess you stick with it long enough.
Yeah.
You find whatever path is going to be best for you.
So yeah.
I was almost, you know, there was a few times where I was like, I don't think that I want to do this much longer, but
yeah,
something kept me sticking to it. It was never the money part.
Like, yeah,
I feel like, you know, like you were doing construction before you
yeah.
started. I did too.
Yeah,
I did it since I was 15.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still have all my tools. Like
yeah.
even in LA, when I used to work for Pete at Little Dog,
yeah,
I go over and do construction stuff at his house.
Yeah,
like for extra money. Like,
right.
It was just always something that's yeah. like, hey man, worst case scenario, I'll bust out the tools and
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
get food on the table. But,
yeah,
stuck with it, and it's been a good payoff.
Yeah.
You know, but now I'm in my mid-40s, so you kind of like, what's the rest of the ride like? You
know, right, right.
Danny Love, who taught me how to drive, is still around. He works for the same bus company
That's
I
great.
Do. He doesn't drive anymore. He
right.
He basically does, like, all the quality control and makes sure drivers are ready to go and that they're knowledgeable about the buses
yeah.
before they leave.
Yeah.
The company I work for has 160 buses.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it's like a fleet of airplanes.
Yeah.
If you sat in an airport and watched all the people that got to tend yeah. to an airplane.
Yeah.
Same thing, but a different,
yeah.
you know, type of world, but... He's the guy that makes sure everybody's ready. So
yeah.
it's funny that I still get to work with him.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, please tell him I said hi when you see him.
I will. I told him the other day that you live in my neighborhood. And he's yeah. like, you got to be kidding. He goes, I've thought about that guy a lot over time. And I didn't know it, but Blake had done Dwight tours with Pete a long time ago.
Yeah.
Like doing merch and maybe like whatever else was thrown at him. And he was on a bus with Danny Love.
Too
funny. And I didn't, you know, I didn't know Danny Love or Blake through one or the other, but now all of a sudden it's like, we all came from this little nucleus.
Very
so
cool.
That's the whole story.
That's cool, man. Congratulations, man. That's huge. Yeah. I'm so glad that that's working out, and I think that that's awesome. And again, the fact that you live down the street is just killer. So
it is, man. Now I'm excited to see when you have gigs and I'm in town. Now I can come check it out. I love being able to go over and see Blake. Dude, you're a rock throw from my house.
I know, it's crazy. It's crazy.
I hope we take advantage of it. You know, I don't know how much longer I'm going to live in Tennessee.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Montana's coming. But
my house is so great and affordable that it's going to be hard to let go. So I'm not going to do it for a while. It's got to be for the right reasons.
Yeah, sure.
It's on the horizon.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, man. I'm glad you continued on with everything, man. Especially the first album that I started working with you. You kind of have a relationship with anything that you put that much labor into, and even though I wasn't there when you guys recorded it, I loved that album.
Yeah.
You know, like every tune on it is great.
Good.
I wasn't there for the next one you did,
right,
with Little Dog, but as I listened to it, it's just as great, and I could see myself falling with it. But you know, I've heard those songs from time to time, like on I still listen to like Outlaw Country.
Sure.
Elizabeth Cook has played your stuff from time to time.
Yeah.
I think I've even heard it on like the Buddy and Jim show.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Way a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Just throw out a tune.
Yeah, it's
like, dude, it brings you right back to where you were when you started. So,
yeah,
congrats to you. Keep on going, man. It is a tough business, and
it's something. It's interesting. It's I think it's just what I do naturally is to write songs. Like it's what I do when there's no other distractions and when there's distractions. Yeah, it's just what I normally do. So I don't know that there'd be I don't know that it's any great, you know, thing that I have a part in. It's just
it's a natural part of you now.
Yeah. So but it's that time was certainly formative. You know, like I still have dreams to this day about Pete. You know, like dreams where like we see each other and we're always on like opposite sides of the street. You know, and like it's always very tense. But I love him dearly. I sincerely do. He took a shot on me and believed, you know, like way before anybody else. So it was it's a shame the way it all sort of ended. And if I could go back in time and do things differently with hindsight, you know, I would do things differently. But I think at the time, I think when I left, I think I was really burned out. You know, like burned out with the fighting with Pete and the just the all the touring and all like the that whole time seemed pretty stressful to me, and I just didn't know I was burned out. I just thought I should retire and be done and go back to like being a stage actor or something. You know, like I just thought it was done. Like I didn't think you were supposed to feel that way. But if somebody could have said, like, dude, I just think you need a break. You know, like, and just, like, you need to step away from this for, like, a month or two. But I didn't – I thought it was the end, and it was, like, you know, the next chapter to
you
do something else.
You just kept pushing yourself to the wall, and then you were the wall.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And it's a shame because I feel like I feel like it was a disappointment for Pete. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like I disappointed him. As far as, you know, not sort of living up to his sort of vision or whatever. And just, you know, when you're that age, you do some out shit, you know what I mean? Like, you do some, like, strange shit, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and I think, it's just a shame. It's just a shame the way it went down. I am glad that there are guys who are in that same, you know, in the same bullpen there and did make it out and made it out like you and Adam. I think that's good. You know what I mean? I don't know that it was easy for really anybody at that point, but I think some people made it out better than others. You know what I mean? And like, again, yeah. We've never heard from Cisco again, you know?
Right.
You know, so I don't know what that means, but yeah, I think, you know, we just keep pushing, you know, that's our little deal. So
yeah, that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
It was, and I said it probably earlier in this podcast, it was an incubator.
Yeah.
It was my college.
Yeah.
For how to get on the road and how to survive. Like,
yeah.
There's still people I met on that first tour that I run into this day.
Yeah.
In Houston, Austin. And it takes me a minute to like go, you were that guy at the Mucky Duck in Houston. Or, you know, you were that guy in Nashville at Third and Lindsay. And to this day, like, you know, you guys have definitely had a hard relationship and an intense one because of the whole aspect of being on a record label and making music that close with him and him, you guys being in a band together.
Yeah.
I wasn't around when it dissolved.
Right.
But to everybody's credit, and I had to learn this in this business because not everybody has great relationships their entire time in life.
Yeah.
So whenever I've seen you, you've never had a bad word about him.
No.
You've had nothing, but I learned a lot. And when I go to see him, because if I am in LA and I have the time, I like to check in and see the guy.
Yeah.
And he has great stories. He still makes me laugh. Yeah. He checks in on how I'm doing.
Yeah.
He wants to know, you know, what I've been up to, and vice versa. He doesn't have a negative word to say about you. I think for him, because he had been through so many other things
with
like Dwight and maybe even other situations.
Like,
to him, it was the same as to us in a different way.
Yeah.
It was a professional learning experience where he's like, well, you know, made a lot of great music.
Yeah.
And it was time to move on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to this day, Jennifer Harold, who you answered the phone the first time I ever called, I'm good friends with her.
Yeah, it's
I
great.
Don't see her all the time, but when we do catch up, it's like, you know, you just go back to that time when you first had the first conversation.
Yeah.
You're like, how the hell are you doing?
Yeah. Too cool.
So,
It's
a weird business, man, but it's one degree of separation.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm sure you still run into those same people that you used to play when you were at Tootsie's. And they're still around town.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this town has gone crazy.
Like, it's insane now, right?
It doesn't have, you know, even when I moved here 17 years ago, I lived in a P.O. box and had a storage unit before I ever bought a home.
Right.
It took me, I looked at 40 houses before I bought mine.
Yeah.
And at that time, like, Nashville was kind of going through this weird thing where overproduced music was the fad again. And then this second wave of stuff of songwriters came in where it was kind of outlaw country again for a while.
Yeah.
And then now it's turned into a city where everything happens. It's a rock city. It's a rap city.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, melting pot. To I don't recognize it as much as when I first moved here, but I think anybody who ever moved here could say the same thing. Like, well, it used to be like this when I first moved here. And it was. It was definitely a different city in 2007 and 8 when I bought my house compared to now. Like, Madison was not the best neighborhood.
No.
It's this side of Madison was always fairly good.
Yeah.
But there was still some sketchy stuff that happened when I bought my house.
Yeah.
It's totally changed now.
Yeah.
This is like the new East Nashville.
Yeah.
But with bigger properties.
Yeah.
And you can't subdivide these properties. So our neighborhood is going to stay the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, house-wise. So
yeah.
I think if anything, that's probably what like kind of keeps me here is my neighborhood still feels like it did when I bought.
But that's fair.
The rest of Nashville is like evolved into this weird thing I don't totally recognize.
Yeah.
You know, like when people come visit, you could take them downtown to Robert's Western World,
right,
or Tootsie's or Layla's,
yeah,
to the Ryman, to the Grand Ole Opry,
and right,
it had a, like a heritage feel and a historical perspective. And now you go down there and you see these buses with the tops cut off and bachelorette parties and people throwing up on the streets.
Yeah.
Not that people haven't been throwing up on the streets in Nashville for decades, but now it's like so often that it's
become
like this, you know, like Mardi Gras on Bourbon Street
it's
versus
true.
Mardi Gras in New Orleans in other places is a different thing. Bourbon Street's kind of the shit show.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, Broadway in downtown Nashville is the shit show.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, let me show you what this city's about.
Yeah.
No, I don't really go take people to the same places.
Yeah. It's hard to be down there.
Yeah. But still, you know, more affordable. Cost of living wise than as far as music cities go, Austin and LA are astronomical.
Yeah.
You're paying to live there and you'll never be able to save
unless
you're, you know, a millionaire.
Yeah, 100%.
Nashville is still somebody where you can, like, a place where you can save and work and, you know, tread water.
Yeah, fair. Yeah.
100%. Your family's still in New Jersey?
Family's still in New Jersey,
parents still...
Parents still together, still alive, Grandpa just turned 100 on Monday.
Wow.
Yeah.
You got longevity in your veins.
Something. Looks like we'll need it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a long fight.
That's right. But yeah, they're all good. Brother's hanging tough. They're all killing.
Awesome, man.
Yeah. Yeah, and then...
I like good outcomes.
That's a good
story. We're both still here. And
man.
We can laugh about everything. And,
again, how bizarre is it that we're all, like, within walking distance of each other?
I'm
it's
blown
crazy.
Away.
Yeah,
I'm
me
actually,
too.
Like, I've told Blake it a couple times on text messages. I'm like, I can't believe you're...
Yeah.
And you've been here 2 years. Like, how you've probably watched me mow my lawn sporadically and been like, what is that guy doing?
I haven't. I've never seen any... I've never looked over there. It's funny I never recognized the house.
Yeah.
Yeah, from like when the times we stayed there, but just goes to show you, you know.
Yeah, well,
I have no sense of direction. I have no sense of direction. So, it's not unbelievable that it's lost on me, but too funny.
Are you looking to stay here for a while?
Like home? I think we're happy here. I mean, you know, we like this house, you know, and I mean, you know, I think you have to be here. I think that there are opportunities to happen here that don't happen anywhere else. You know what I mean?
It still is that city.
Yeah.
Musically, especially.
Yeah, and I think though we're like in the time period of like. I think it's real heavily influenced and focused on like sort of women in Americana music at the moment, which is cool, whatever, you know, like, but I feel like our time is sort of somewhere in the future, you know what I mean? So, but well, I think, I mean, the fact that just the fact that we're here, like me, you know, Blake's here, like it all seems to be like just,
there's
beginning to,
it
it's all just coming, it's all in you know, ahead. So, I feel great about it. We like it here, and it's pretty chill.
Yeah. Sometimes it just takes, like, the right song at the right moment, and it's not it is an age, like, especially music commercially that blows up really quickly here. Mm. Can be associated with looks,
sure,
or like popularity, or what maybe the mass of a crowd is looking for, but still at the root of it, it's all about a song, and its content and how it relates, and that doesn't have an age,
right?
Here,
that's fair,
So it doesn't matter anymore if that's your focus great songwriting, and you constantly just keep scratching that wall.
Yeah.
Because if you're a true songwriter, like, you have to go through all these ups and downs.
Sure.
Of,
yeah.
You know, if somebody just shot to great success right away.
Right.
Their songs follow a lot of that, maybe.
Right.
Like how, yeah, and how they would approach writing and why they're writing versus like, God, I got my heart broke again, and I'm homeless, but, you know, I'm here, and,
yeah,
you know, life makes the man,
sure,
and man writes the songs.
Yeah, so it's fair. It's
fair. You're in a good spot regardless.
Like, yeah.
And you got a hell of a catalog, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not well acquainted with your last three albums. I didn't realize that one of your albums was made with Kenny Vaughn.
Two albums.
Two of them?
Yeah, he produced two of them, yeah.
And Blake had told me one of them was pretty much the Superlatives.
That was Man About Town album, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And I love a lot of what the Superlatives do.
Yeah,
and I like Kenny Vaughn's playing. I've seen him at D's. And yeah. Off time, he plays like a blues rock
song. Yeah.
You know, it's almost like going to see like a Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Fuck, I didn't even know he did this.
Yeah.
So, dude, your catalog's great, man.
Yeah. You have
like a really good body of work where you could play for 3 hours.
Yeah.
If you needed to.
Yeah.
You don't want to, you know.
No,
hopefully
no.
You're doing an hour and 45 with right, encore, right, yeah, and that's yeah, your set. But,
yeah,
you know, you got a lot to choose from. I can't believe how many songs you've written now.
Yeah.
You've never stopped.
Yeah. That's always been great. You know, I mean, the songs have always been great. And we've always managed to somehow get an album out, you know, every couple of years, you know. And I love that. And I love, you know, obviously, after working with Pete, I love working with guitar players who produce, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the last two albums, Blake, and do you remember Brownie, Jody Sappington?
Yeah.
Like, so
when I went to Michelle and started playing with her, and I had to leave you as the crappy rogue manager.
Right.
I had to pass the torch on to Jody at that time. He was doing studio engineering.
Yeah.
And he was going to become the rogue manager.
So. And then we went to Europe, right? I think.
Yeah. So he talked to me and was just like, I remember like when it was supposed to, like, tell me everything I need to know that you think I should know. And I'm just like, all right. So we sat down for like, you know, 20 minutes or something.
Yeah.
He's a pretty intelligent guy.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart.
Got it down. But I never worked with him, but I know who he is. And I think he grew up in Montana.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too funny.
So he's still around? He's your bass player?
No. He engineered and played a little bass and helped produce the last two albums.
Okay.
Like we did, I think he knew somebody who had a studio for the first album we did together, and then the second album we recorded in Blake's living room in Encino. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And too funny.
That was the last place I saw Blake before.
Yeah.
About a week ago.
Isn't this place cool?
Yeah. Oh, it's a great house.
Yeah.
And they got in at a good price.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Everything about it.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Great backyard.
Yeah, totally.
Cool dog.
Yeah.
But yeah, he lived near, kind of in that time before I started bus driving, there was an Irish rock band named Young Dubliners.
Oh, yeah.
That Sally Browder had worked with.
Okay.
So during the time that I had to hustle, I was doing construction stuff.
Yeah.
Keith asked me over to his house to build a fence for a wedding. And that's the lead singer of the Young Dubliners.
Yeah, yeah.
Irish rock band. And then while I was there, we got to know each other. And he hired me as like a road tech. So I went on some tours with him.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like Colorado ski resorts.
Yeah.
I think friends with that guy to this day. But Blake lived really close to
him. Okay.
So like the other day when I went there, I was like, when is the last time I saw Blake and Wendy?
Yeah.
And I traced it down. I'm like, it was when I saw Keith before he moved. And that was like 8 years ago or 9 years ago. Last time I saw you, guys actually did an in-store at downtown It's closed now.
Country.
How do I not remember this?
Oh, Ernest Tubb.
Ernest Tubb's record store. Unfortunately, not there anymore.
Yeah.
And you guys did an in-store there.
Okay.
And Blake told me the time.
Yeah.
And it was an hour off. So when I got there to come see you guys play.
We were already done.
You were folding your shit up.
Awesome.
And I'm like, ah! But I saw you and Blake, and I'm like, guys, I'm sorry I didn't catch any of it. But it was good. That's the last time I saw you.
Too funny.
That might have been 12 years ago.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was.
That's the last time I caught up with you. But
too funny.
Well, now you're a stone's throw, so.
Yeah.
I'll start knocking on your window in the middle of the night.
Yeah, man.
You're going to hate me.
Oh, man, it's going to be great. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Now, that's wild. Yeah.
So, how long are usually the podcasts?
They're varying speed. Like, I can sometimes chop them up and make them two episodes. You know, like this one, we can wrap up. I think we got, you know, I think we got our story done.
Yeah, we covered it, man.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk, dude.
Yeah, we're at an hour and 38. Yeah, it was great. It was great to talk to you, and it was great to see you again. And, yeah, man, it's good to be around you. I appreciate you doing this, and I'm just thrilled that things are good for you. I think it's awesome.
We're in the neighborhood, man. Yeah. Call me if you need anything.
Will do. All right, I'm going to leave it there.
All right, bud.
All right, pal.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bo Meek and his many road stories. Bo, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was awesome having you. Folks, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, you can check out MootDavis.com, and you can check out Moot Davis on Instagram. And if you'd be so kind, please give us a subscribe and a like wherever you're listening to this at, and we'll see you on the next one. All right, later.